Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwinninger and Matthew Giener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis and practical application that you can take back into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
You know, pickpockets nowadays, instead of stealing people's wallets, are putting thumb drives in their pockets instead. They're being called foot pockets. No rim shot.
I'm just imagining like various like stick this in your computer or I'll shoot you.
Well, hold on. We got to drive to my house and then we got to You also think that a thumb drive can have a crypto wallet on it too.
Yeah.
So like putting a wallet in your pocket. But, you know, probably not what's on the thumb drives you're putting in your pocket.
Yeah.
So the first article is small-time crime is about to explode and we aren't ready.
That's going to be a mess.
And this comes to us from Talos, which is Cisco's threat intel section. So the summary, FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, IC3, received 847,000 complaints, with each victim losing more than $8,000 on average. Now, in 2017, that was 300,000 complaints with an average of $4,600. So when you do the math on that, that comes out to be the number of attacks has tripled, but the costs have quadrupled. Or I'm sorry, quintupled. So five times as many. So the cost has gone up five times, but the number of attacks has gone up three times.
Yeah. And that's interesting, as you mentioned, the $8,000 on average. I think we've talked about this in the past. Isn't there a number for online crime that most police will not investigate under?
Yeah, I think it varies based on jurisdiction. And we'll get into this a little bit later. But it used to be
down.
But we will get into the fact that the cops aren't going to look into it. So the article supposes that criminals are turning to cybercrime instead of pursuing traditional drug crime.
What? But I thought being a traditional drug criminal was such a rewarding career.
I'm sure there's some cultural aspect to it. I mean, it's hard to sound or act tough when you don't necessarily have to participate in violence in order to perform your criminal actions. Something here for the what's the word I'm looking for? The persona of someone who's in one of these drug gangs, right? Where in order to be perceived or respected, then you would have had to have done something dangerous or possibly that you may get arrested for. And if all that is hidden behind a keyboard and mouse and a digital trail, it's much harder to have the bona fides, which says that you're tough or you're capable or whatever, in some place that's traditionally has a relatively high amount of violence involved in it.
Yeah. And I mean, there's also the remuneration part of it. I don't know if you remember the book Freakonomics, but they did a study on how much the street level drug dealers made, but it was about the same as you would make at McDonald's. It was about minimum wage.
Right. Yeah. So, I remember hearing about that. I've never read that book, but I've heard that other places as well.
Yeah, it's not terribly remunerative, but I guess it has its benefits in terms of street respect.
Right. Yeah. And like I said, there's a culture around that if you're stuck in that environment. Now, of course, if they are participating more in cybercrime versus drug crime, then you're going to see violence go down on the streets. And this author supposes that this is going to add significant amount of pressure to local law enforcement. Which makes absolutely no sense to me at all. I think this guy is, in a perfect world, maybe it would, but in actuality, it's not going to increase the pressure on local law enforcement because they barely actually deal with real crime. The murder clearance rate in the United States on average is 55%. And if you include all major crime, it comes out to be only 28%. You know, and this is part of the whole propaganda that everyone gets indoctrinated in on TV and everything. I've never seen an episode of Law and Order, but I'm guessing that 45% of the time, the crooks do not get away on those shows.
Yeah, I saw an interesting tweet about Law and Order and like CSU and all that stuff, and they were like talking about how it's the most effective propaganda for police ever made. About right. how, you know, every yep. time something bad happens to you, there's a whole team of experts that are there to help you out and find the bad guy. And in reality, it's usually like one or two guys.
Yeah.
And they're overworked and they've got a ton of cases and yeah.
Yep. And, you know, and if you've ever had to deal with the cops in some kind of scenario where you've been wronged, and I'll just give you a simple anecdote from my own experience, is I had my car parked on the street. Someone ran into it and knocked it off in out of the street, onto the sidewalk. And when I called the insurance company, they're like, well, you have to call the cops. The cops have to come out and look at it. You got to file a police report. And the cop comes out and the first thing he said out of his mouth was, we're not going to catch this guy because we don't do that CSI crap. And I was like, oh, I'm sort of glad I had to call the police who aren't going to do anything for me. It was awesome. And the same thing actually happened when I had a credit card stolen. Or the number stole, or no one actually took the card from me, but they bought DirecTV with it. And this is years ago when the banks used to have you call the cops and file a report anyway for a stolen credit card. You don't have to do that anymore. So they call the cops and they were like, yeah, we're not going to do anything about this either. And it was like, was DirecTV, you'd call them and get the address where the DirecTV was purchased from. You could actually find these people. It's like, yeah, it's not worth our effort. So this guy is, I think, living in fantasy land.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the local law enforcement bit. So
right.
He says cybercrime is a local law enforcement problem. For cybercrime to get the attention of national law enforcement, you've got to steal a lot of money. I think you said the threshold is around $100,000.
In one of the articles that I read, they mentioned that they don't look at anything less than $100,000 that will even remotely get their attention. I've heard from other sources that it's much, much higher than that.
And it's easier to cash out a small payday than large sums of cash. A criminal can walk into a big box store and buy a couple $100 worth of gift cards using a stolen credit card relatively easily. Yep, that makes sense. And really, like the local, how you wrote in the notes here, you have no idea how a local law enforcement agency is supposed to investigate cybercrime, especially when the person committing it is almost certainly nowhere near you. Grandma comes in and she's like, I got this call from India from this person who just bilked me out of $4,000. And what exactly are they supposed to do? They don't have anybody who probably has the skill set to do anything about it. And even if they have the skill set to do anything about it, they don't have the access to actually go in.
Well, cops coordinating with other cops all across the world, if it's worth it, but it's not going to be worth it for him to call, you know, the corresponding police in India to investigate this or whatever. The error that this guy is making is that he thinks because it's too small to be a national problem that the local police will deal with it. But the fact of the matter is, it's too small for the national cops to deal with it. And the local cops have other things that they are focusing on to deal with. It may or may not be small time to them, depending on $8,000 to $10,000. It depends on the jurisdiction. But they've got actual crime to deal with where there's physical violence involved, et cetera. They are not going to have time nor the cybercrime expertise on staff in order to address these problems.
Yeah. This basically means that there's a certain level of criminal that is now going to be almost completely free from any possibility of retribution from police. If you were a drug dealer on the side of the road, you could risk having a SWAT team drop down on you. You could risk being shot by, you know, other drug dealers. You risk violence. You risk years in jail. But instead now you can just work out of your home and your air conditioning and your heat, and you can make, you know, a couple $100,000 a year. As long as you're doing it from small bits like this, as long as you're hitting people in maybe other countries and face 0.01% chance of actually being arrested. And if you are arrested, it's a white collar crime. You're probably going to go to a minimum security prison.
Yeah, it really depends on how greedy you are.
Yeah.
If you want to just earn like a middle class living doing cybercrime, you could easily do it and not pop up on anybody's radar.
Yeah, probably only need to do 10 or 20 hours a week.
Yeah, it's a good thing crime doesn't pay.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Talos speculates that because cybercrime is on the rise, that they should be able to correlate that to a decrease in drug crime, which they weren't able to do. There's a chart in the article which shows a steady decrease in drug crime over time. And there's no precipice or no drop off or anything that seems to indicate that there was a sharp decline in drug crime with the corresponding rise in cybercrime. Now, if he tries to say that national law enforcement database don't have the granularity necessary in order to dig into this, so he tries to do so by looking at the New York Police Department's database. The one problem with that is that that data has been shown to be inaccurate. So if you go and you read the NYPD tapes inside the Bed-Stuy 81st Precinct article from the Village Voice in 2010, they get deep into, this is a article focused around a police officer whistleblower for what was going on in NYPD. And they were all fudging their numbers in order to make it look like they were performing the job that they were supposed to in actually reducing crime. And here's a quote from the article. One supervisor says, "You know, I've been doing this for over 8 years and I've seen a lot. The lengths people will go to try not to take a report or not to take a report for seven major crimes. So nothing surprises me anymore."
I'm shocked that people would falsify their metrics.
Right. It's a very long, detailed three article piece in the Village Voice that you can find online. I think it was worth the read. But if you actually take the time to dig into that, they focus around the facts that New York started digitizing and tracking the metrics around crimes. And lo and behold, when they started measuring and collecting those metrics, the cops started fudging the numbers, or they started gaming the system in order to make their numbers look better.
Yeah, I don't know if you would see direct correlation, because I don't think this is the type of crime that you would see, like somebody just one day decides to, like, I'm not going back out on the street today. I'm going to start, you know, hacking web servers.
Yeah, he thinks you can go from, it's like the trope where somebody else in the government said, oh, you just need to learn to code and you'll be,
you just need to retrain. Yeah,
you just need to retrain.
Yeah, I think this is probably more like, yeah, like kids that would otherwise potentially go into being a criminal are instead like, hey, you know, rather than join this gang, or maybe even when they join the gang, they're like, you know what? I don't need a gun. I'm not going out on the street. How about I help you get paid this way? And I don't go out on the street.
Right. That seems more likely. But based on reading the articles, and there's another one in here from Forbes, it seemed like they're more like trying to augment their criminal enterprise with cybercrime.
When did legalization start?
Well, that was with Colorado, what, 4 years ago?
November 2012. Shows a steady decrease in drug crime from 2013 to present.
Yeah, I don't think Colorado legalized it in 2012, though, did they?
Yeah.
It wasn't that long.
I just looked it up. In November 2012, Colorado legalized marijuana for adults age 21 and over.
Holy cow, this is what happens when you get old. Everything seems like it was not that long ago.
Yeah, you're not kidding. That's 10 years ago. So I have to wonder how much of it has to do with that. And maybe there is no correlation between the drug, because I can't imagine that a gang or any kind of criminal enterprise, you know, gang or mafia or whatever, like if it makes them money, they're going to do both.
Right. So you think it's more pressure of they weren't able to maintain the amount of money that they were getting from drugs, so they had to augment it with cybercrime?
I don't think they had to. I think they chose to, because I think cybercrime is just safer and more pleasant. And I would rather be doing cybercrime than working the street myself.
I think those these are feedies we talked about.
I think it's almost coincidental.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the case. And the article from Forbes, the Miami street gang see no hope in dope. So they're switching to identity theft fueled by Russian hackers. In this article, it's completely secondary to the drug crime. They arrest the gang or they search the gang's house all around drug crime. They don't search them for the cyber criminal activity. They just coincidentally find these documents or whatever relating to cyber crime when investigating drug and violent crime. And the quote from the Forbes article is, "Plenty of evidence available to prosecutors. Current and former police officers say there's often not much of an appetite to jail gangsters for fraud, largely because single frauds aren't big enough, even if the overall cost is significant." So that goes back to the argument we were having a minute ago. that local law enforcement is not investigating these people for the cybercrime. Yeah. And they just coincidentally found this stuff because of the drug crime. And really, these guys aren't doing well. I guess they aren't the one, they're doing identity theft and things like that. So someone else is stealing the data, they're buying the data, and then they are leveraging that data to commit fraud is really what's going on. I suppose you can call fraud cybercrime, but I don't know. I think there's a little bit of a nuance there. There can be an argument made that isn't necessarily cybercrime per se, if you're committing fraud with data that you acquired from someone else.
Yeah, but that's probably a good starting place. They probably start there and then they're like, these are crappy pieces of information. How do we get better pieces of information? And that kind of leads them down the road.
Well, it could be. But then they'd have to acquire the talent in order to get that information.
Yeah, but I don't think it's that hard. I mean, I was reading an article on LinkedIn the other day that was talking about how terrible most software is and how we're making it so easy for hackers because our software is all bad.
Right. So something else where they may pick up the skills necessary to commit this fraud is in jail. Because when they go to jail, it's actually like going to school for them. They'll learn different criminal techniques from other prisoners when they go in jail that they have not been exposed to before. Now, if you listen to the Lex Fridman podcast with Brett Johnson, who used to run Shadow Crew, he talks about this, how he was basically teaching classes in how to conduct fraud while he was in jail when he got incarcerated. And it just adds another tool to the toolkit for any other criminal who's in there for a different reason. But the whole reason we're talking about this is this is evidence of a serious problem. And with the economic downturn, this is only going to get worse. And the problem is that there's no incentive for either national or local law enforcement to do anything about it. National level is too small. And at the local level, they've got other problems to deal with that they're not going to deal with cybercrime, which may not even be in their jurisdiction. They're not going to track down a criminal in California who's stealing $500 from a retiree in Florida. It's just not going to happen. So unfortunately, this is really going to be on individuals and businesses to do prevention, because you're not going to catch these people as a private citizen. So the best you can do is do the best you can in order to prevent being a victim of these attackers.
And I think that we should probably expect on the corporate side to see more and more small attackers.
Right. You know, overall, we would like the environment in which we live, it improves people's lives to the point where they don't have to turn to crime in order to have their basic needs met.
Oh, my sweet summer child.
Well, we're not going to get there. So that's why we're talking, people need to do the prevention that's necessary. So there needs to be an improvement in system and software security. Average people need to be able to be educated on just basic things they can do to improve their own security. Use a password manager. Always use MFA. If you have MFA, choose the time-based token versus the SMS. I would recommend using a major email provider like Gmail, who does a really good job of, I mean, as much as I don't like Google, Gmail does do a really good job of filtering out the spam and your basic low-level email phishing attacks and things of that nature.
All right. Article number two for today. Malicious PyPI packages turn Discord into password stealing malware. This is from Leaping Computer. Summary is a dozen malicious PyPI packages have been discovered installing malware that modifies the Discord client to become an information stealing backdoor and stealing data from web browsers and Roblox. I believe that is a direct quote from Leaping Computer, because I couldn't write a better summary than that. So this is this article, and this is funny because actually now that I'm looking, I'm seeing several other articles about PyPI. So since this stuff has started coming out, there's been a number of other people that have started looking into PyPI and been finding a bunch of other malicious ones. So I'm going to stick several other articles with other interesting ones in here, but they're all kind of similar in the sense that the end result is all the same. So there were 12 packages uploaded to PyPI, the Python Package Index, on August 1st, 2022, by a user named Scary Coder, which is at SNCC. Is SNCC supposed to be snake? It's snick.io. Is it snickio? Is it snake? Is it?
I don't know. Did they have a pronunciation guide?
Just sometimes these places, I don't like the names they choose. Anyways, they discovered and publicized this. This one's a little different. We've talked in the past about typo squatting, where they use like misspelled requests to try and sneak in there. But these are normally named packages that say they deliver normal features such as Roblox tools, thread management, and quote, a very basic hacking module, which I don't know what a very basic hacking module is. I tried to go and find this, but they had removed these. And so I just searched on PyPI for Roblox modules and hacking modules. And actually did find one that was about breaking into and getting like free Roblox auth. And so I downloaded it and opened it up in Atom to check out what it did. It was completely blank. Somebody had posted something on PyPI that was supposedly a hacking module. It was completely blank.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
They aren't even making any money off it. So what was the point of that?
I don't know. Well, it wasn't blank. It was what it was like the default. It was like the default.
It was like the shell.
Yeah, it was the shell that you can download that has all the stubs for you to fill in. It was very weird. Somebody else had a WhatsApp command and control server. I downloaded and poked through that. There's a bunch of cool stuff on PyPI that I had no idea was there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, usually when I deal with PyPI, I already know which one I'm looking for because I have a problem I want to solve. So I do some Googling to find out what module I need in order to solve that problem.
Yeah,
I get the same name. And then I get it from PyPI. So I don't go trolling PyPI for whatever.
Yeah, I had not done this either. But when if you search Roblox, you get several thousand packages there. And if you search hacking, you get several thousand packages. Although I don't know that I would just download anything that I found. Anyways, but these packages install malware on the developer system. And I was curious if they actually performed the stated Roblox tools or thread management function, but unfortunately I couldn't find any validation if they actually did that or not. According to the article, they had not been removed as of 8/17, but they had been removed as of today 20, because I tried to go find them because I really wanted to see what the basic hacking module was, but it was gone. The report by SNCC, if you follow the link to this page, and I'll put the link to the original SNCC.io, it doesn't show all of them. They just show their reverse work on ciphers. Although they do state that they all work very similarly, except for two, which have a single executable.main.exe, which matches up with one of these. The way they work is they contain URL requests to download some wacky named zyxmne.mn.exe and zyrbx.exe. Those are the malicious executables. They're hosted on a Discord CDN. The setup.py file is super simple. URL request to download them. Then it opens them, writes them to disk under a semi-random, it appears, name. It runs them, and then it deletes the name, deletes the file afterwards. So they're just running in memory. The first one is used to steal information from browsers and from Discord. It goes in and looks up your stored passwords, your browser history, your cookies and search history. And it decrypts them using the master key for the database. And it also modifies the index.js file in your Discord to add a script that steals your auth tokens, nitro status, billing info, and credit cards from Discord. And then it exfiltrates all that to a Discord webhook.
So the thing to note here is don't store your passwords in your browser. Use an actual password manager.
And then the next one. The next .exe file focuses solely on Roblox. It pulls out the account cookie, which I assume you can use to log into the account. Someone else can use to log into the account. The user ID, your Robux balance, your premium status, and then also exfiltrates that to a Discord webhook. I assume that you can use the information it steals on Roblox to then log in and steal their Robux and steal their items. Apparently, the items in Roblox are worth real money. Some of my son's friends actually make some real money trading and making bots to trade Robux items. When they reverse engineered the executables, they found out that both executables are actually Python and are made with PyInstaller. I guess that's not really a surprise.
Python all the way down.
It's Python all the way down. I love that the author had to include their own messages. They included Soulcord run to world is, I think, the first message that they send back to the Discord server when it checks in.
Does that have any special meaning to you? Because it doesn't to me. Because you said the second one is Sonic the Hedgehog reference.
Yeah. So if you look into the main function of zyxmn.exe, so it sets up the webhook, then it creates a ping message, Soulcord run to world. Then it sets green hill zone content F at everyone ping message. So, and then Python, the F is a format, formatting the string, and then it sends the JSON content. So it's sending that to the webhook. So the ping message is what it's sending to the Discord webhook. So it's sending Soulcord run to world to at everyone in that Discord. So that's just how we chose to kind of notify that the system is checked in. A new system is checked in. Soulcord run the world. I don't know. I didn't search it to see. No, nothing comes up in Google. Yeah, it's just, I'm just amused. This is the sort of thing that gets you in trouble as a malware author, right? Is including these little things that, you know, make it discernibly yours. Now I'm wondering, like, how many other pieces of malware have something about SoulCord in them. So, and if I ever write malware in the future, I'm going to include this in there. And
well, you should anyway. Be giving somebody else credit then.
But I don't want to have the credit if I was writing malware, right? Anyways, the actual delivery and running, the download, the URL request and download, it isn't obfuscated at all in setup.py. Anybody opening setup.py and looking in there is like, huh, this is weird. It's downloading and running these executables. That's super weird. And I'm surprised they didn't even try to name it anything like roblox api.exe, just to kind of be in keeping with the package. Because then you could look in and you'd be like, oh, maybe the API requires some sort of local helper. Well, that kind of makes sense. No, they didn't even bother doing that. Although on the other hand, I guess I can't remember the number. I can't count the number of times that I've actually opened up something I've downloaded with PyPI because I never have. Of course, I also don't download weird random ones. I usually try to use pretty well-known public ones, but meh.
I have because one of them was broken.
The original write-up from snyk.io is actually pretty awesome. I think you should definitely check it out if you're interested in malware. There's also a Kaspersky report where they detail two other PyPI packages that contained info stealing malware and also modified the Discord client. These were PyQuest and Ultra requests, which were kind of supersets of other popular projects like requests. These guys focused on slightly different information to steal, including account credentials from cryptocurrency wallets, Steam, Minecraft, email address and credentials, billing information. Then they go rifling through your downloads, documents, and desktop folders looking for 2FA recovery lists, password text files. I keep all mine in my desktop folder with a big password.txt file.
You're not using a spreadsheet?
It's just got an ASCII middle finger.
Nice. And how many times has your hard drive been formatted mysteriously?
Yeah.
In the Bleeping Computer article, there are Z and other articles about other malicious Py packages. So this is like not in any particular way, but this just came to our attention recently.
Yeah. And even today, I just logged into our Feedly this morning and there's already like three more articles on malicious PyPI packages in the Feedly. So this is, although this one is, there's 241 PyPI packages that drop XMRig. So there's just, anyways.
Yeah. There's got to be gazillion PyPI packages.
Yeah. And the article, I don't know if they complained strictly about it, but they did say PyPI's response was slow with the malicious packages remaining online for almost 2 weeks, a little over 2 weeks after being reported. And the article suggested this was, quote, likely the result of a small team of volunteers with a limited budget being overwhelmed by constant malware uploads.
Yeah, and that's got to be great.
Yeah, and they linked to an article.
Spend no time improving PyPI because they're dealing with malicious packages on PyPI.
They linked to an article from just days before where PyPI packages were conducting DDoS attacks on Counter-Strike servers. And I just can't help but think of, isn't this just like OpenSSL, where like the internet is working on the backs of free and open source volunteers? And maybe some company needs to come in and adopt PyPI and fund it and put some actual paid people here.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to think of, I think PyPI is almost exclusively where I would ever get packages from.
Yeah.
I don't think I've used anything else.
I feel like there used to be a different one for Python, but yeah, I mean, lately it's been all I've been using for Python packages. So anyways, why does this matter? Well, developers try and write as little original code as possible, as they should. There's no sense in being duplicative and inefficient. Why have a developer spend, you know, weeks rewriting the request library when it exists online? Where they find the code is the problem. They're going to go out to open source repositories like PyPI, and they're going to go out and copy and paste things they found on Quora without necessarily diving into it to make sure they fully understand it. And these particular packages are probably not a corporate threat. You're probably not using, you know, Discord and Roblox on your corporate network for any business critical applications, but there are almost certainly more subtle dangers in PyPI that haven't yet been caught.
Right. That may be business applicable.
Yeah. So what should you do about it?
Well, we have code analysis tools that look for mistakes in programming code, you know, static and dynamic code analysis. So there really needs to be more of these for actually malcode in the discovery of malcode in source code. There are some out there when I did some Googling for them, but I wasn't able to find any major brands that you would recognize that produce these. So your mileage may vary about the quality of those that are being produced. But I think the more that this happens, the more important it's going to be. And I'm kind of surprised that some of the bigger vendors don't have a clear offering for this kind of analysis.
And I'm wondering actually, because this wouldn't necessarily have been caught by malware analysis because it was just pulling down and running some executables. Or would that have been caught by malware analysis? Or is there scanning that looks for like really rare libraries or really rare packages? Like, oh, this user here is using packages that nobody else in the company is using.
I don't know. But I was thinking if you had, you know, some mail code analysis tool, there might be some commonalities that they would be able to identify in source code and say, hey, this is typically a malicious call out or something like that.
And I wonder if they're doing that now at like the XMRig one, how they found all those packages using XMRig. I wonder if they can find like a specific URL and then go out and search for other packages using that URL or with a specific line of code, see if they can find people that have just copied and pasted the same code into multiple packages.
It could be. I think that GitHub does some of this with the code that's on there in their repositories.
Yeah. Yep. So other thing you can do is make sure that your developers are using common and well-understood packages, not copies with extra additions or typo squats. Although I think the typo squats one probably would be handled by what David was talking about, the code scanning. That probably does look for misspellings. At least I hope so.
One can dream.
Yeah. Anything else about snake.io?
Nope.
No snake. Go snake. Go. All right. Well, thanks for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter @SerengetiSec and subscribe and listen on your favorite podcast app.